Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
And welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, episode number 167. My name is Adrian Hobart.
My name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers of the following four genres:
thrillers,
mysteries,
crime,
and suspense. Well, welcome to the show. 167 episodes young.
And, speak for me.
It is. It's a real pleasure to be here. Our guest this week is C. McGee.
Another Over the Pond interview.
Well, Caleb Husband is his real name, and he is actually a professor. But he's also a crime author, humorous crime author. And he talks to us about the experience of writing his book and the techniques of engaging a younger audience nowadays. With all the technology around, how do you actually become a professor that people listen to?
He is actually on TikTok, and I've yet to look him up, but yeah, I want to follow him on TikTok.
So, C. McGee joining us a little later from across the pond in North Carolina. Very exciting to speak to him. Now, news-wise, one story really stands out this week, and it's this one from the Female Leadership in Publishing group.
Flip.
Been going 2 or 3 years now, and it is, well, self-explanatory, really. It is trying to look out for the best interests of women leaders in the publishing industry. And they've just done a survey, which is covered in the in an exclusive in the bookseller, that 60% of publishing staffers feel their salaries cannot cover their living costs. 60%.
It doesn't surprise me.
While 97% of those who engaged in the survey have experienced burnout.
Doesn't surprise me either, because it's one of those jobs you do for passion rather than money.
Yeah, but don't you think, we'll go further into this, but, again, publishing doesn't exactly cover itself with glory when it comes to, human relations and resources.
No.
Because, it does rely on people do it for the love of it.
Exactly, I mean, that's what it was like when I started. It was that sort of atmosphere of gratitude. You got in the door. So you shouldn't be thinking about how much you get paid.
Well, the media was like that as well. The sort of broadcast media that I was in, certainly at certain sectors, totally exploitative wages.
Yeah.
And, years before I made a living, it must be said.
Well, I didn't even get to that stage, I don't think, before I went on maternity leave.
No.
I got to the level of editor, right? An editor sounds reasonably prestigious, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But I think your eyes would water if you knew what my salary was.
Well, totally. Well, look, 749 people responded to the survey. That's pretty substantial. When you consider that, most national polling surveys have only about a sample of about 1,000. This is pretty comprehensive.
How many was it again?
749,000. No, 749 people.
Sorry. Yeah. Okay.
That's pretty representative, I would say, in an industry like
publishing.
Very
precise. Yeah.
Anyway, and this was a survey that was run by the Bookseller and the Women's Prize Trust, and reflected concerns around fair pay, transparency, meaningful representation across all levels, underrepresented backgrounds experiencing more unsustainable workloads, as well as parental leave and achieving a work-life balance. Wow. So money emerged as a significant concern in the survey. Overall, 58% of respondents disagreed or strongly disagreed that their salaries could cover their living costs, with the percentage rising to more than two-thirds of those with additional caring responsibilities, and three-quarters, 76%, of those working part-time. Only around a quarter of respondents reporting a disability thought that their salary was fair, and only 7% of respondents were earning between £15,000 to £25,000 agreed that their salaries could cover their living costs. Which, you know, it's staggering, isn't it? Yeah, and burnout. Now, let's have a look at that statistically.
Yes.
So it says, strikingly, 97% of respondents admitted to having experienced burnout.
So only 3% said they hadn't. That's just terrible.
Yeah, well, yeah. With 42% saying it happened often or always. Additionally, women, who made up 92% of the respondents, were around 50% more likely than men to report having experienced burnout. Yeah. Well, then again, you know, there's a cultural thing here, where blokes don't like to admit that they're burnt out.
Partly, yeah. And
I've been there. And, you know, you don't admit it until you really are totally whacked.
And also, I don't know if this is a stereotype, but women are more likely to just keep going and keep going and keep going, I think. At least of a certain generation of women.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think there's a lot to be got here. You know, I think in general terms, publishing is exploitative in the traditional sense, in the traditional area. And, you know, look, it's tough for the indies too. You know, no one's going to pretend that anyone at Hoback's getting rich. You know, we're not. Quite far from it. But, you know, it's our choice, as opposed to, you know, you take a job with a major publisher and then, you know, you're expected to do way over. And I think also, you know, the creative industries fall into this trap, and this happens in all sorts of sides of the creative industries, and, you know, including acting and things like that. And in the world that I experienced in broadcasting, in TV and radio particularly, it is very easy for things to be burned out because of the level of nervous energy in the environment that you're working in. Because
yeah.
You're working to deadlines, you're on air live, it's a performance, you're on stage. There's a lot of near hysteria. I'm sorry, my chair is rubbing against my microphone behind here, and it's driving me to distraction.
Well, I was saying the other day, wasn't I, that when I went on maternity leave, the first thing I thought of, the first thing that came to my head was, thank goodness I don't have to worry about schedules anymore.
Mm.
And it's because publishing, it's just that constant battling time,
yeah.
Battling the calendar.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you set a publication date, and there's an awful lot of things that have to happen correctly in the right order by a certain point for it to happen. And,
Yeah. You
know, there is also, I think, this thing within the creative world of, you know, one person lets you down somewhere along the line at some point, and then from there forever on, you are anticipating that to happen again. And so, therefore, a lot of the burnout potential is around the jeopardy.
Yeah, it's a fear of failure. It's a fear of it being you responsible for something going wrong. And that is huge in publishing. And we've talked about this before, the sort of blame culture, which naturally generates from any product that you've got to put out that's got to be perfect, or as perfect as you can possibly make it. And the sort of the ramifications of it not being perfect. But I remember my boss saying to me once when I was running around solving a problem, getting very stressed, and she said, you're not an A&E doctor. Nobody's going to die. If it goes wrong, it goes wrong, and we'll move on.
Yes. Yeah, there is an element of that. But at the same time, it's just really... there's also this culture, if something does go wrong, I used to remember this happening all the time in the departments I worked for at the BBC. If something went wrong, everyone gloried in it. They absolutely loved pointing the finger.
It was, yeah, that's that blame thing.
Oh, but I mean, honestly, it was like the rabid wolves gathering.
Because they're glad it's not them.
It was awful. Yeah, well, to some extent, but I think there was just this pleasure that people took, real pleasure. I mean, to the point of, it was very hard to reconcile with the people that you were working with otherwise. But, you know, we would love it. You know, we'd always glory in on-air mistakes that got recorded as for the showreel of, you know, bad things happen on air. Like, for instance, there's a guy, bless him, he's still with us, and though many of us working with him will wonder how, a guy called Mike Vince, and he was an overnight sports reader on Five Live. He's very well known in sort of racing circles. And he fell asleep twice during one bulletin.
Racing circles?
Yeah. he
You fell asleep.
He fell asleep, yeah. So it was something along the lines of, you know, and the number one race that is going on later today is...
I love that. I love that.
Poor bloke. I mean, you know, he really struggled. I mean, doing overnights was brutal, and I did many years of doing overnight work. But yeah, he fell asleep live on it. He was as he was talking.
That's brilliant.
So that's famous. But
he obviously wasn't too stressed then.
No. But anyway, so that is a warning sign to the publishing industry. I mean, clearly people going into it, and we felt this when we went to Exeter last year to talk to students about getting into publishing. The elephant in the room was simply that, you know, oh yeah, great industry, la la la, this is how we did it, and you know, of course things are different nowadays, but you know, show your passion and go for it. None of us said, and you're going to be paid, you know, barely minimum wage to work in London. So unless you've got...
Well, I did try and encourage people to look for jobs out of London
You did. But it's survival of the richest to get into this game.
Well, it's... Yeah.
Which is why when you look around London Book Fair, in terms of the people from this country who are attending, it's a certain class and caste.
Yeah, they're trying to change that though, aren't they? But it certainly was when I started.
You can't do that on 15 grand a year.
No. I mean, I struggled, yes. I mean, we're talking 25 years ago, it was 13 and a half grand, my starting salary.
Yeah, I mean, my first job, full-time job in independent local radio as deputy news editor of a radio station was, this is back in 1995, and I was being paid $10,250.
Yeah.
And I could barely pay my rent.
No, because you're doing it for, you got in the door, you've got past the interview. And I remember, Oxford, I used to walk past Oxford University Press before I got the job there and think, oh, to work there. And you'd see the people coming out the front door and you'd think, oh, they're so amazing.
But then, you see, it's interesting is because I've been going sort of through, you know, over the last, since we set up Hoback really, and started launching this podcast and talking about, you know, that transition between being in a job for 25 years that defined me, you know, the letters BBC. I was very proud of carrying the card.
Yeah, I was, and I still am. I'm still very proud that I.
Despite all the things that I've subsequently said about how much I hate the place, you put up with it at the time, and
well, yeah, but I think they're separate, aren't they? So you're proud of what the BBC represents throughout its lifetime, and being part of that.
It gave me kudos and status in my mind, but actually, when I reflect on it, did it really? You know, was I more than that? And it was an environment which made you feel, you know, all the way through, no matter where you reached in that organisation, count yourself lucky you're here.
Yeah.
And any organisation that takes that attitude, in my opinion, needs a really long look at itself. So as an industry, publishing needs to really address that because, you know, you can't keep trading on it and exploiting to the extent that they do. And I think that's true on all levels. So I don't actually know who's making the money. That's what I want to know because, you know, at what level do people... I mean, the record industry was similar, wasn't it? That, you know, how many artists that we think of as mega, mega famous and successful in the 60s all say that it wasn't until the mid-70s they actually made any money.
Yeah, I don't think it's that dissimilar in publishing, really. I mean, you see the statistics on what best-selling literary authors earn and all that sort of thing. Mm. It's so opaque anyway.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know where all the money goes and we don't know who earns it. Are they paying a pittance partly because they would collapse if they paid a reasonable wage in publishing because of the price of books and the fact that, you know, we can't...
Well, there are all sorts of price pressures, but one thing they've artificially kept low is pay.
Well, yeah, so. I know, but so...
Anyway, okay, right, well, we'll move off that subject and move to our interview. But you ought to say that we've got a very exciting announcement to make after our interview because on this show, and I'll talk about this at greater length, but, you know, we have been talking about AI incessantly for weeks and months now and all the impacts it's having on publishing, good and bad, mostly bad in our view. But we have something, you know, we've been reflecting on that and we'll make an announcement after the interview.
We found a use for AI that benefits us. More later.
Okay, let's go to our interview with C. McGee. Now, Caleb is a professor of political science in North Carolina. His boss is his wife, and the other professor.
Yes.
At this particular
I mean, why would two people work together and live together? I mean, I can't imagine wanting to do
well,
that.
Well, you wouldn't catch me doing it. And he's the author of Owen O'Shea, Stay-at-Home Dad, Wannabe Detective. It's humorous, very it's beautifully written. Sort of, no, I wouldn't say a parody, but it is a mystery. And
yes.
But it's full of humour and about being a new dad as well. So it's a terrific book. So let's talk to C. McGee. What an absolute delight it is to cross the ocean again for a second week running and talk to an American author, in this case, C. McGee. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It really is a pleasure. And I must confess, I know we've had your PDF for a bit of time. I only started reading it a few hours ago, and I was laughing like a drain throughout because it really captured the zeitgeist of being a young parent. If nothing else, your book, Owen O'Shea, Stay-at-Home Dad, Wannabe Detective, just had me laughing in almost weeping with laughter.
Well, I think we've both been there, haven't we?
Yeah,
so
sure.
That's wonderful. I mean, that was the main goal, to have people laugh and enjoy it. So I'm really glad to hear that.
Yeah, and it's you capture so well so many. I think even in the first few pages where you he's playing rock paper scissors to see who has
Lizard
to attend
Spock.
to the youngster. I think all young parents have been in that position. I mean, I must admit, I think of my parents' generation, for whom it would never have been a question of the dad getting up and doing this sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, things have moved on a long way from the 70s, where it would be, essentially mother's role.
My dad didn't do anything. He could barely cook a sausage. When he was in charge of cooking our lunch one day a week, because my mum's a nurse and she worked on a Saturday, it was always burnt sausages and lumpy mash. That's all he could do.
Mm. not the most skilled chef, no.
No, but it's an interesting contrast we're talking within a lifetime. So many things have changed. And what we're now at this point is this horse trading that goes on in a relationship when you're sleep deprived and stressed beyond belief.
Yeah. Oh, and the sleep deprivation makes everything more difficult. I'm blown away with. Well, I mean, on the positive side, I had this idea for this book when I was up in the middle of the night at 2 a.m. So something good came of it. But overall, I feel like I'm a pretty happy and easygoing person. But man, I'm kind of a jerk when I don't get any sleep. And you just don't get any sleep. Like, people tell you that before you become a parent, but I don't think you fully appreciate it until you're actually up at like 2 a.m. Man, it is rough.
It's really rough. I remember it really well. And I did it three times. I must be mad.
That's unbelievable. Because after once, I was like, oh, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, we've got five between us. So, the scars are deep.
And they're all boys as well.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, I don't know what that. I only have a little girl. So I have no idea what. But I mean, when they're that age, when they're infants, I feel like it's all the same. It's just crying and waking up at ungodly hours on, 4 hours of sleep.
But yeah, I mean, you have a background as a soccer player and coach. And so in that sense, if you had boys, it's dead easy because all you've got to do is, like dogs, you've got to exercise them twice a day. And generally speaking, to a certain age, they behave themselves.
Mine weren't like that.
No, they weren't, were they?
No.
Mine were. All I had to do was force myself somehow to find the energy to run around for a half an hour with a football.
Yeah.
And then you get, fairly easy life after that.
No, yeah, I think back on that, and we are fortunate enough to grow up and kind of live currently in this suburban idyllic neighborhood where kids are still like, they just go out and play in the street and all that sort of stuff. And it's wonderful, but there is, my daughter's athletic and she plays sports, but it's not to the degree that it dominates most of the boys' lives in this neighborhood. They're out playing basketball and soccer just all the time. And she does those things, but not to that degree where they just run until they have absolutely no more energy and then just pass out asleep. Because that sounds great. If I can get my parenting offloaded onto sports and tiring them out, that sounds wonderful. Let's do that.
Yeah. We'll see. But in terms of that background and where you are now, really, I'm interested to know how you came to writing, because I heard somewhere that, you know, it's when you realized that you'd reached your threshold at soccer and what you could achieve in it, and you wanted another challenge, and writing came to you at that point.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think I've always needed something that there was a good chance I wasn't going to succeed at, which I don't know why. I don't know what that says about me. But so growing up, the goal was always to kind of make it as like a professional soccer player. And so whenever I was on different academy teams and played in college and then had pro trials with what would be like the third division here in the US. So I'm not talking big money. I'm talking like if I would have made it, I would have made like 30K a year, right? It's not big time. But I've got brought in by three of those teams and I got cut from the last one and I came back to uni to like finish it off. And I was like, oh, like I gotta have another plan. So A, I had to figure out something else to do with my life. And then B, I realized immediately that I needed something that was quite possibly out of reach to strive for. And I think writing was that thing for me, especially getting a novel out there and published and all that. It's the success rate is just like, right, appallingly small. So that, and then also just having a creative outlet. I'd like writing for its own sake as well. So, yeah.
I mean, what do you get from it in the sense of what does it give back to you?
That's a great question. I like imagining stuff, right? And I mean, lying, you basically get a lie, right? But it's not lying because you label it as fiction and then you get to do whatever you want. And I've always been tangent prone, and so kind of letting my mind wander has always led me into weird realms. And so now all of a sudden, sometimes I was like, those would be good stories. And so yeah. And also my dad grew up telling me stories like in the car when we were on car trips and stuff like that. So there's a bit of nostalgic element to it, I guess, as well. But narrative has always fascinated me. I love television, I love books, I love film. So yes, I was super athletic into sports kid, but I was also always into movies and books. I wasn't into TV that much until streaming came along and all of a sudden TV got way better, right? So yeah.
I like that tangent prone. That's what they should have a t-shirt with that. I'm tangent prone.
You certainly are.
So are you.
All right.
But
Proud of it.
it's almost like made me think when you think about your childhood, because when we're children, we make up stories all the time. Most
Right.
most children do in your head on car journeys, and you know, you said you had your dad telling you stories, but it's almost like a license to be that child still, but have more sophisticated stories, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice. That makes me feel warm and fuzzy when you phrase it that way. I like that one.
And yet, in this book, you kill people. So,
Yeah.
although we ought to let you in on this, because when Rebecca looked at the cover, she just made the assumption it's a cozy, and it's
Yeah.
not. It's a
Yeah.
mystery, but it's not a cozy.
No, it's, I'm not gonna lie, with the marketing and agent stuff, that was tricky business. Because it has the amateur sleuth, right? Which is a whole thing. And I went back and forth with Crooked Lane, which is like a great indie publisher of mysteries here, a bunch of times. And overall, they were great. And they gave me tons of great feedback and they improved the book. But I had a back and forth with them. At one point, they were like, we want it to be closer to Only Murders in the Building, which is, yeah, there's a little bit of gore stuff, but it's pretty cozy. And in my head, I was like, I wanted it to be more like, well, to use another TV reference, Barry, the one where the guy becomes a, you know, he's an assassin, but then he finds himself in the theater. And I think I ended up kind of halfway in between those, which I like being in that place. I feel like there's a lot of cozy mysteries, but there aren't too many mysteries that are fun and funny, but still adult with some not going overboard with it, but there's some, you know, swear words, and there's some a little bit of gore, and there's like a little bit of sex. And I don't feel like there's enough that kind of hits that in between ground, which is just honestly what I like. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Humor and crime, because we have this discussion quite a
We
lot, don't
do a
we?
lot, yeah.
That, you know, some people might say, well, why would you have something funny in a book about killing people? But actually, it's a human need to laugh in times of distress and in times when we can't cope. So we make a joke out of it. I mean, you know. So I think that I agree with you. I think there should be more of that sort of, it's not cozy, but it allows humor as well as the grit to exist, coexist.
So, well, I'm glad to hear that, obviously, because we're on a try and hit. But no, I love that. And I don't know, it might just be, well, you all know far more about publishing and the market and all that sort of stuff, but it is kind of hard to find. It doesn't fit into an existing niche perfectly, which is tricky.
Yeah, and I think the crime genre as a whole is perhaps less forgiving the audience of people who try to work in between the gaps in the in those niches, because I think in fantasy particularly, and also in romance, there are so many disparate things that there's always an audience for a certain micro element of that
That
archetype.
mountain goat romance in space, that sort of
That
thing.
kind of, well, I mean, as I famously talk about on this podcast several times, I was offered a leprechaun romance, steamy romance, to narrate.
Needs an
And
audio book narrator.
yeah, it was
Oh, that'd be
one of my
so
hats.
good.
So he had to do, what was it, a Bostonian leprechaun
There's a
from
best,
Texas?
right. So the story was that they were originally from Dublin. They lived in Boston, but they spent 10 years living in Galveston. And so I had to reflect, and the accent had to reflect all three things.
You turned it down though, didn't you?
Oh, and there was apparently a little Brooklyn
He
element
spent
there
some
as well.
time in Brooklyn, hadn't he? So, yeah,
I mean, go figure.
can you do
That
that accent?
would be quite a linguistic feat. I don't know. Bostonian, the car park? I
Yeah,
don't know.
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
Right.
man. I can't even. Oof.
Yeah, it was quite something. Anyway, I mean, I think the point I'm making is that those other broad genres are so much more forgiving. And actually, what we've discovered, because quite a number of our authors have approached us with great stories and we have published, is that sometimes if it's not defiantly cozy, or if it's not defiantly a police
Thriller.
adventure, or an international thriller, or whatever, it's much, much harder to find an audience, I think, at the moment in crime. And so, I do admire your determination to stick with that. But a lot of traditional publishers would say, "No, I'm sorry, you've got to make a decision. It's going to be one or the other, and you can't mix."
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I mean, I'm not sure I knew that when I was writing it. I was just writing the book
Oh,
I
no.
wanted to
Yeah.
read. So, you know, in hindsight, would I've done? No, I think I still would have written this book. I love, and some, it's nice when I come across a book that is different in some way. It doesn't even have to be wildly different, just truly something out of the ordinary within the genre. It always is, seems more notable to me. And it sticks out. And I, even if it's kind of a mediocre book, I'll end up giving it like one more star than it probably deserves just because it doesn't, you know what I mean, fit into one of those pre-existing, well-defined genre categories.
Well, it's sorry,
I was
go
going to say books like that tend to do well out of word of mouth because there's an author I'm thinking of, he's called Dan Rhodes. And I couldn't tell you what genre he writes because they contain humor, but they're sort of not quite literary fiction, but they're very funny. And I only know about him because someone recommended him, and I've done the same. I recommend him, but he doesn't fit into a genre, and I think he has struggled with that himself. So, you know, That's interesting.
you just need to get people to spread the word.
Yeah. Well, I'm literally writing down his name as we speak. So obviously, I'm going
Yeah,
to check
look
him
him
out.
up.
So
He's
it's
really good. He's
successful.
But I'm interested, as you're a professor by day and an author by night.
Oh, that sounds very mysterious,
Yeah,
doesn't
it does.
it?
Makes me sound like a
Murder, He
superhero.
Wrote. What I'm interested to know is, from the perspective of being in that position of with your day job, working with students to enhance their work, to prompt them in different directions of what, thinking and the way they express themselves. How difficult is it then to be working with a publisher who's offering you in reverse that advice and that input?
Oh, that's a good question. Difficult. I mean, it's difficult, not in that I'm opposed to getting feedback or constructive criticism. I love that. I think it's difficult in knowing which advice to take and which to fully take, which to kind of take, and then which to not. And sometimes you're just going to be wrong. And so there's no right or wrong answer to that, and that is tough. And as a professor, there's certain things. So I teach political science, so it's gray there. There's a lot of gray, but there's also some things that are just wrong. There's like 435 members of the House of Representatives. That's the answer, right? Versus in something subjective like writing a novel, it's okay, you think this should be cozier, but that's not objectively true. So, but maybe you're right. And so I don't know how to assess through that. My wife, Beth, she's always the first to read everything. And she's told me to tighten my novels numerous times. And it's great advice. And from my first two, I'm not sure I listened appropriately and took her advice enough. And I think this one's much better because I tightened it a lot. Like I cut, I don't know, 20,000 words, and it's infinitely better. What is it? The kill your darlings line. It is hard because a lot of what I end up cutting are lines that are like objectively, I go back and read the lines I cut and I'm like, damn, that's funny. But it ruins the flow. And so I was holding on to it because it was funny, but it made the book worse as a whole. And that's something I've really come to appreciate, you know. So Beth will be saying I told you so because she did tell me so for like two novels worth. So that's like 6 years. But this novel's doing better than the other two by a lot. And I'm sure that she has a lot to do with it. So she deserves a lot of the credit.
But I mean, in a way, that's, the first two novels are often people finding their voice, and it's that and their craft. You need to get those first books. I mean, it's amazing how many authors we've spoken to on this show who have the books in the drawer,
Yeah, who they won't look at.
which they won't ever look at again. But also, for instance, quite a lot of independent authors who were traditionally published did three books for a traditional publisher, got dropped. And at that point, they actually found their voice, and their success came, 3 to 6. I mean, Ian Rankin is the famous one in the mystery and crime thing in this country. His books, he's been writing those rebus books, and I think he's on 25 of them now. But the first six are utterly forgettable.
Yeah, I actually read the first one for it was a reading group many, many years ago, and I remember reading it thinking it's okay,
And it was only
but you
book seven
know,
he finally found what
yeah,
he was about. And
it's
he was very
interesting.
lucky they had a publisher who was prepared to stick around that long to wait for him to get good.
Yeah, well, and a credit to him to keep going as well. I mean, I feel like so many writers are gonna, so many people I know are like, I'm gonna write this one book, and if it goes, it goes, and if not, I'm done. Because it is, it's tough. It's like it's a ton of time. It's exhausting. You have to love it to keep going with it for sure. Yeah.
I was watching a documentary about, it's a music reference really, but Pete Townshend of The Who.
Yeah.
And the sense with which he approached the creation of Quadrophenia, which was released in 73, 74, something like that. But he'd been working on it for 2 years, and he was just, by the point they actually released it, he was just desperate to get it out there. He didn't care anymore. And
Yeah.
that is actually where I think a lot of authors will get to the fun bit, the initial, I don't know, 25% of the book, it all seems flowing. And then you get to the point where you get to 50,
Stuck stage, I
get
call it.
stuck. I mean, I always get stuck at 50%, and then I know what the ending is, but I get tired of trying to get to it. It
Yeah.
seems to get away from you. Same with narration. Always, every project I've ever done with narration, it's hard to start, and then it gets flowing, and by the end you're just so tired of doing it, you just want it done and out the door.
Isn't it the same with anything though?
But I think that's one of the things that is people don't really take into account when they're writing.
No, and it's interesting. So for me, actually, as I'm approaching the end of like the first draft, it actually goes fast because I can see the end and I actually like feel my pulse going up, which is awesome. The brutal part for me are the revisions. Oh man, the revisions are just soul sick because you're not creating in the same way. No, and the creation is what's fun, right? And so that is just brutal. But it is, I agree, Rebecca, it's the same for everything. I mean, I can't tell you how many friends I have from grad school that are still all but dissertation, right? So they've done all their coursework for their doctoral degree and they haven't finished because the dissertation is just like this last hurdle. And it's shocking. I mean, that's 4 to 5 years worth of work that just that last hurdle trips them up. But yeah, with revisions, that's really the case. I find I get better energy if I actually finish the book. I have Beth, my wife, beta read it. And actually my mother-in-law also beta reads it. And she's awesome. She's a huge mystery fan. So she's great.
Right.
And, but I leave it for like 6 weeks and then come back because I'm much more refreshed. And I can also see the crappy parts of the novel, like in highlighter after 6 weeks versus when it was immediately after I finished writing it, I couldn't see them. And all of a sudden they'd like stand out 3D off the page after when I read it 6 weeks later.
Another tip is read it out loud. Cause then it's like reading it fresh because you're hearing it. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, my dad taught me that the first paper I ever wrote in second grade. I still remember it. He's like, always read your papers out loud because you're going to hear when something is off. And that was great advice. I still do it to this day. People think I'm a lunatic. As soon as I'm on my laptop reading. I'll do it
you're
in the
not,
coffee
you're
shop.
You're not a lunatic because we tell everyone to do that, don't we?
I'm intrigued to know whether there's a bleed through between your academic writing, your research papers, whatever it might be, and the fiction. Do you have to be incredibly disciplined, use a different part of the brain, or what happens there?
So I've kind of finagled the system. And so I'm
that's
lucky.
A good word, finagled.
There you are.
I'm fortunate. I teach at like a small liberal arts college. And so
there's only two in the department. I saw that on your website.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And the other one who's my boss is my wife. So there's that.
I did wonder actually, but it wasn't completely clear. And I thought, is his wife in the other one in the department?
Yeah. Yep. Yep. So, and the school is pretty cool. So we have such a heavy teaching load that the paper writing part, we do need to do research, but it's not like the research you would have to do at R1 big research university. And so they count these philosophy and essays as publications. So you'll probably see them in, I don't know, Barnes & Noble, whatever your bookstore is that's local, is like Harry Potter and philosophy or Ted Lasso and philosophy. Oh, I've written for a bunch of those, which is super fun because it counts as an academic publication. But since it's for public consumption, they really encourage you to be fun and Yeah, it's still rigorous in that, like, they check that your thesis is on point and that you're representing the philosopher's work correctly and all that sort of stuff. But really, you can get pretty creative with it. And so that, I think my last, like, six pubs have been Ted Lasso and philosophy, The Expanse and philosophy, The Joker and philosophy. So, yeah, I mean, I'm using my creative brain. It's almost encouraged. So I get to be creative almost all the time, which is super fun.
I want your job.
It is pretty great. I mean, it doesn't pay the best, but it's a great job. I can't complain at all. I would choose it over and over again.
Now, I'm intrigued. I mean, clearly you're a professor of political science, and we are entering a year with 70 major elections around the world.
Yeah.
Being one here and one year where you are. And we had an example last week with the House of Representatives having a very strong influence on the future of publishing, in the sense that
TikTok.
If TikTok gets banned and, you know, the parent company doesn't sell it to, US interests, then it's going to get banned. And we were at this event, London Book Fair, last week, where three TikTok, BookTok influencers were saying, they're not even thinking about it. But the truth is, there's a really good example of something that has suddenly boosted publishing being, you know, a victim of international power plays. It's fascinating. What I suppose I'm coming to is, with your in your professional capacity, do you look at those issues with greater interest because you are a published author and the impact that those things, you know, that
the impact of politics on publishing?
No, that's very interesting. I made a conscious effort not to be political, especially with this one, for a few reasons. One, the goal was to be entertaining and make people laugh and turn pages. And two, I don't know if it's the same necessarily in the UK. I suspect that there is a great deal of overlap, but it's gotten to the point where we have very few cultural touchstones in the United States that avoid politics. And I think that in order to keep a country together and like make civil society function, you need things that like people can talk about around, like the water cooler, right? Like water cooler issues or water cooler. And it just is fun stuff. And there's fewer and fewer of those, because, well, at least in the States, the two political parties both try and politicize everything. Which sometimes I'm just like, I just want to eat this fast food without taking a stance on anything. Sometimes to throw my students off, I like to eat Ben and Jerry's and Chick-fil-A at the same time, because the one is very left-leaning and one is very right-leaning. And just to give them a curveball.
I didn't know you had food that was left-leaning and right-leaning. I've never heard that.
I guess it's the creators and the ownership, isn't it? That makes it.
So what was Ben and Jerry's? Was that left?
That'd be left-leaning.
What was the other one?
Yep. Chick-fil-A is like chicken sandwiches, and it's like right-leaning in that their owners basically just give money to right-leaning causes. Not overtly advertising their causes like Ben and Jerry's does, but everybody knows, right?
That's interesting, isn't it? So what you're saying, that everything has got a political element to it.
Yeah, but I think there's an interesting thing going on in society, in the sense that I think a lot of content creators, particularly the streaming services and indeed the networks over here and over there, are being sort of bounced around or deliberately trying to stay ahead of wherever society is moving. And so therefore, almost every bit of content seems to have an underlying societal message that you're supposed to adopt. And so many choices are being made on that basis, rather than simply putting something out there because it's funny or it's informative or anything like that. There has to be an extra element to the commissioning process that underscores some issue. Do you think that's fair?
I do. I also don't think it's sustainable, right? No. I think the old model, once asked Michael Jordan why he's not political, and he said, because Republicans buy sneakers too. And I was like,
good answer,
good. That's a good answer, Michael Jordan. And I think that he's correct in the long term. I don't think you can continue to have every single company make some sort of political stand about everything. It's just it fractures society even more. And just from a business standpoint, I don't think it's good business, unless you're a company that like is overtly like, our whole shtick is we're recycled free trade. Okay. Yeah. Then by all means be political, because you have a clear audience. But if you are a fast food place, or basically like 90% of businesses, I think it's a losing game for you to take those stances, because you're alienating a significant portion of your buyers. And that's just, I think it's a mistake. And it's already bitten some of these companies in the butt. So I think that they're going to, I know people in the business world that have said they're already steering away from that.
I want to know where Haagen-Dazs sits.
Haagen-Dazs, tell me immediately. I love your creme brulee ice cream.
I bet if you, this is controversial.
Say it in Denmark.
No. But what I'm thinking of is how many times on Twitter recently I've seen images of German companies, getting branding at Nuremberg rallies or the Olympics or whatever it is. And so therefore the one that I saw the other day, black and white image of the Mercedes logo surrounded by SS stormtroopers on
From
parade
Star
somewhere.
Wars.
No, the Nazis.
No.
The Nazis.
Not
Wars.
at the
Oh.
behest of the Emperor and Darth Vader, no.
Oh.
And it, you know, and how that constantly is being dragged back up from the 1936 or wherever it was, and
Yeah.
saying, well, you shouldn't be buying Siemens or anything else from BASF or any of these other companies, or indeed any of the car makers from Germany, because they were all up to their necks in it. And it just strikes me as very odd to keep going back there.
No, yeah, it's odd, and I think it's seen as a useful tactic, but I actually think the vast majority of people hate that. That's not how they view things. And sometimes I think the algorithms of social media have made it so a handful of voices that are the most bombastic and radical on either side of the aisle get elevated, and it skews our perspective of what normal is and what just regular people that just want to enjoy their life and have fun with their family and go to a job they
And
like
just eat ice
think.
cream.
Yes, I just want to eat ice cream.
Yeah, even though it was
Exactly.
Hitler's favorite, Haagen-Dazs.
If
I'm just, you know.
it's double chocolate, I want to eat it. I don't care who's eating it.
But I mean, let's go back to, you've mentioned big tech and social media. How comfortable are you? Because one of the things that the modern author and the modern publishing company needs to do to get noticed, it
Oh,
feels,
go on TikTok.
is to engage in all these different platforms. And at the same time, I can't think of many people actually being very comfortable doing that sometimes. But what about you? Where's your position in terms of promoting your writing,
Oh, in the digital
in
world.
the digital world? Yeah.
Different this time around. So I grew up in the upper Midwest, which is known for its like be humble and meek sort of Scandinavian roots. And so talking myself up on social media was just like anathema to me. Like no, I couldn't do it. I can talk myself up in person because I can do it with a wink and a nudge and I'm joking, right?
Yeah, you're right.
Versus online, it feels like slimy and gross. But I had a big conversation with people close to me who I value their opinion, and they're like, look, that's kind of just where it's at, and you're not going to change it. And so you need to find a way that you can do it that you enjoy and you're comfortable with. And so actually, TikTok, it's funny you brought that up, is even though I don't necessarily love what it's done to like my students and their attention spans and all that sort of stuff, I actually enjoy creating TikTok content. Like it's fun. I used to agonize over like a tweet because words are super important to me. And then I would tweet it out and I'd be like, nope, I don't like that. And I would delete it. And then, oh, it's awful. TikTok, I just make goofy videos and then post them. And I'm like, my wife and I would be joking around like that in the living room anyway. So now I'm just filming it and it's whatever. It's goofy stuff that you post online. So TikTok has really been the first one that I've ever felt like I've gotten traction with and I've felt comfortable with. And so
Interesting.
I've been doing that. Like I have whatever, Insta and Facebook and all that sort of stuff, but I don't do a lot with them versus the TikTok thing over the last like 2 months, I've actually kind of gotten into it. I don't spend a ton of time scrolling on my own, but creating content's fun.
All right, I'll have to look out for you. I do scroll through TikTok sometimes.
It was only after coming from back from London Book
Oh,
Fair
you
that
started looking.
started looking. I have reactivated my account, and I do watch with some pleasure the 25 extra followers I get every day, it seems, even though I've never posted anything on there. So who knows?
Yeah, it's got its weird rules, though, hasn't it,
But what I
TikTok?
mean, here's it's just tangential. So this is we are mutually tangential people. So
Yeah.
we're in a
I
safe
get
place. But I do wonder, because one of the things that if I had my time again, I think I would like to go into what the area you're in terms of teaching and academia to a degree. I wonder whether have you had to TikTokify
TikTok.
delivering the message to your students? Do you have to grab their attention? Do you have to keep
But they
dropping?
can't scroll you up
Because I've attention deficit disorder, and so therefore when I was in lectures, I was just like counting the holes in the roof tiles
I
or
used to count
whatever,
the chewing gum.
or
The bits of chewing gum on
wondering what fluid it
the
was that created the stain on those
I used to make maps
same
out
tiles.
of the fluid on the,
Yeah,
pretend it was a world.
exactly. Have you had to change your style of approach to delivering, your lectures and things?
I mean, I think I was the same way when I was in undergrad. And so I had already done that, I think, before all the social media stuff came on. And I'm fortunate enough to be at a school where our classes are 15 to 20 people.
Oh, that's good.
And so I already do tons of like simulations, debates, discussions, all that sort of stuff. So I think it's rare that I have a class that's lecture from beginning to end. Very rare. So I think I kind of nipped that in the butt before it was even a problem, right? Before TikTok had already captured their attention and all that sort of stuff. So, but I mean, I tell them straight up, like, no matter how entertaining I am, I can't keep up with, whatever, somebody moon dancing on your TikTok or you flinging, wingless birds in a slingshot across a video game screen. Like, I can't. There's no way. Those things are awesome and they're designed to capture your attention. So you have to make the conscious choice to be like, nope, I'm going to learn for the next hour instead of doing that. And recognizing while doing that there's like one or two out of the 20 that are not going to make the right decision and they're going to, do that. And as long as they're not disrupting the class, it's their choice ultimately. So.
Yeah, and it's weird. I mean, looking at the modern academic landscape, when you're at students in particular, and I think of my sons. One's at university now, one's gone through. You've got one in, one about to go. The fact that people, in my day at university in the 90s, no one had a laptop, no one had a screen, no one
So
had
we had to
anything.
take
We had to
notes.
take notes, and I hated taking notes. I am still to this day a rubbish note taker. Mainly because I was looking at the ceiling. I kind of envied the fact that they've got access to all this. They just record it and then put it through some sort of transcription system, and they've got their course notes. I mean, I'm so jealous.
I'm jealous too.
Well, and if I write up on the board, many of them don't write it. They just take a picture at the end.
Yes.
Like, I can't erase the board immediately after class because at least like five students will walk up and be like, boom, take a picture of it and then leave. Say, thanks, professor.
Are
That's,
you comfortable with that approach? Does anyone have a Remarkable 2 tablet on their
A
desk?
what?
It's a hybrid between like an iPad,
Yeah.
but now it's got a stylus and you write, and
Really?
then it converts it into
I never heard of that, but it.
text that you could share with everybody. They're extraordinary things,
It
really.
is cool. I haven't seen anybody with that yet. But no, I would actually say a fair number of them still take notes on pen and paper, like quite a few.
Really?
Yeah, and there's actually some pretty interesting studies that suggest that we comprehend things better if we have actual paper, right? Like students learn if you give them a chapter out of a regular book, paper, and an ebook, they're going to comprehend more out of the actual book.
Wow.
I've heard that actually. Yeah, if you read a book, a physical book, you're going to comprehend more than if you read it on a Kindle.
Yeah.
And
And
I don't know why particularly, but it's just a thing.
No, I actually, so I don't know why either. Like, I've seen the studies and the results, but I haven't looked at the explanation as to why. But in my mind, when I remember studying for tests and I would write everything on one piece of paper because then I could like see the piece of paper in my head and be like, all right, this was in the top left-hand corner. I circled it and I could see it. Something about like the mind palace sort of thing. And I think that that's true with like a physical book in a way that it's not for an ebook. Don't get me wrong, I have like whatever a Kindle Paperwhite that if I'm traveling, especially I'll read from, but there's no doubt it sticks with me more if I read like an actual physical book.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think
I
you're right.
do like real books. Oh,
Well,
you've got plenty, I can see.
an array. Yes, I know.
yes, yeah.
Plus,
Everyone has, we have bookshelf envy. Yeah.
after you're done, it feels like so cozy to have them in a room with you. I don't know. There's something about a room loaded with books. It's awesome.
Oh, I totally agree. We've got, I don't know, last count was 3,785.
Whoa, that's
That
impressive. It's
does
impressive.
include
And
things like the Gruffalo and the Very Hungry Caterpillar and
I like that. Oh, the kids' books, though, those are a delight. Until, but the books are great until you have to move. And then you have just so many boxes that just weigh so much. And that is
yeah,
a
we
huge
moved
pain.
what, 2 3 years ago now.
Two years ago.
It was not fun.
No.
Boxes of books,
No,
anyway.
indeed. Well, so Owen O'Shea, stay-at-home dad, wannabe detective, is out now. What have you got planned next?
I actually age am just putting the finishing touches on a horror novel, which I've never done before, but the idea kind of hit me, and I it was one of those that like it hit me, and I'm like, yeah, this is good, and I churned it out pretty quick, which is a rarity. Because normally it takes me a while. So I'm excited for that. I also wrote Owen O'Shea intentionally in a way that like it could be a standalone or I could write more on it. But right now next is, you know, the second and third draft of that horror novel. I don't know. I think I might have nailed it like on the first time. So maybe the revisions
You're
won't
getting
be
better at it, that's why.
fingers crossed. So
Oh, that's
that is
very exciting.
next.
Fantastic. Well,
Oh, I know what's coming next.
we've been deeply tangential on this show.
Oh, this one goes good.
But now it is time to delve into Rebecca's world. And
Oh, I
we
like it.
await with bated breath
Buckle up.
Rebecca's random question.
Okay, I want to imagine that you're very angry about something. It doesn't matter what, you're just angry. If you could choose any language to be angry in, what language would you choose and why?
Oh, that's such a good question. I feel like German is kind of scary, right? Like when the Germans get going, it's just like, I don't know, maybe it's history or whatever, but it's got the like guttural sounds and it's just powerful. If somebody's swearing at me in German, I'm like shaking in my boots. So that's gotta be up there, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I also just traveled to Iceland a couple years ago. That language is wild. So long. So like it's so long that if I wanted to like perplex and confuse my opposition, maybe I would use that one. Icelandic or German, those are my answers.
Good answer.
Oh, I
How
think,
about
yeah.
you?
Well, it's funny because I can't remember who said it. Someone quite well known in Britain said German. Just listen to it. It's evil. even when they're being nice. I think it was someone like Ray Winston who said that. I think Italian's a good one
Yes. Angry
because
Italians are
angry
great, aren't they?
Italians,
Lots of gesturing and
you know,
yeah.
that's actually quite often, yeah, because the gestures, you know, you get to, you know, you get your jazz hands
Yep.
with Italian. So I think Italian's my choice.
I'm going to pick Japanese, and partly because I did live there for 2 years, and I just love how the language speeds right up when they're angry, and it just goes. And you'd have no idea, even if you've lived there, when I lived there for 2 years, an angry Japanese person, no idea what they
Well, it's
said.
like when you watch Japanese war films, or at least the bits where they do like Tora, Tora, Tora. So you, the 1970s thing about Midway, all the actors they used Thingy Mifune, you know, the great Japanese actor was in it, and every single thing they say is barked, isn't it?
Yes, it is like that. It's like the sort of, it's not just the language they use. It's not just that they speed it up, but they bark it.
Yeah. So that was my question. So you lived in Japan. That's fascinating. So I feel like when Japanese people who Japanese is their native language are speaking English, it's very from the chest, right?
Yeah.
Like, yes. And it's, is that when they're speaking Japanese, is it also very from the chest?
Yes, I think so. I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, I think you're right. It is very sort of Because they're quite an upright people. They don't slouch like English people do.
Like I'm doing now. Yeah.
Oh, we're super slouchy. We're
Yeah.
so
Well, it's
fun.
funny you say that. So when I came back, because you get culture shock when you go and live abroad, and you get reverse culture shock when you come back. When I came back, I remember walking around the local town and thinking, what is wrong with everybody? They look so down in the dumps because they're all slouching and like, The Japanese people walk with poise and they look up and it's just totally different. And you're right, the speaking as well, it's very sort of all body. Yeah, interesting.
Projecting. It seems strong. Yeah. It's a
It's
good choice for an answer.
fascinating. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm not sure any of us knew which direction this
Well,
conversation
we
would
never
go.
know. We
We never
absolutely
know,
never
and
know.
that's the
I
nature of the
love
show.
it.
It is eclectic, and
It'd be
it
called the Random Podcast.
well, we just at a tangent or something like that. but it's really been fantastic, and C. McGee, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was awesome.
Our thanks to Caleb, and
Yeah.
again, we've had a run of really great
I
interviews
know
recently.
we have, and I love pe speaking to people we've never met, we've never spoken to before. In fact, the first 5 minutes of the podcast is the first time we've ever spoken to them beyond emails, and then we just get on. So
Yeah, we
we've been
get
friends for years.
there's definitely this certain chemistry that sort of develops over those conversations. So we thank him for his time. And our guest next week is Joe Chadwick, who runs Crescent Swan Publishing, based in Essex. And we had one of his other author on the podcast not so long ago, Tim
Yes.
Franks from Wolverhampton. So it'd be lovely to catch up with Joe and finding out what it's like to, have a full-time job and try and run a micro publisher alongside it.
Not that we know how to do that, of
No,
course.
absolutely. Now, we promised that we had some major news to announce, and it feels like this particular day, April the 1st, 2024, is a very significant day in the history of this company, but I think of publishing in general.
Well, it's also the start of a new financial year.
That's true. It is. It is. Which, of course, gives Amazon the excuse not to pay royalties until much later in the week than they normally would. But anyway, who cares? I mean, as long as they're happy. Look, what we've been talking about over recent months is our attitude to AI. In fact, we have on the front page of our website, the Hobet website, an AI policy, which is very clear. We don't allow the use of AI in the way that we generate our content. And that goes for all things that we do. However,
Yeah, there is a however.
the tide of history means that, you can't ignore it. AI is everywhere. In fact, just thinking of the software that I would use to edit this video, or indeed the audio, or any of the other things that we use,
Yeah, it's how you use
AI
it,
is
isn't it?
swinging in and involved. Pretty much everything at Adobe, for instance, who are the sort of the creative rock. Technically, of anything that we do here, they are bringing AI elements in that you can't ignore. You can't actually not use them now because it's so embedded in the
No,
software.
I don't think you could declare you don't use anything that uses AI
No,
in
true.
anything in life. So
No, and indeed, many authors are using AI to help them develop their plots, to write their even write their text, and then they'll go in and tweak it. All sorts of things going on. I've talked ad nauseam, I know, about the influence on AI and narration, replacing human narrators with AIs who are cheaper, quicker, and less. I mean, less likely to make mistakes. Let's put it that way.
Yes, no fluffs. There'll
No
be
fluffs.
AI podcast hosts soon.
Well, there already are, I'm sure. So we thought, it's time that we address this head on. And together with our technical boffin, Mr. Toby Collins, who's currently asleep upstairs, 14-year-old boy genius, we have come up with our own iteration of AI, ChatGPT. ChatGPT was inspired by a conversation that we had some months ago when we realized, having done a survey of our newsletter subscribers, that most of our readers are cat lovers. In fact, it was a vast majority.
Yeah, much more than we expected.
Yeah. And
that led us thinking. I mean, we've already got the cat logo. We've had that since inception 4 years ago. It's behind us. It's on the microphone here. You'll see it everywhere. The Hobeck cat. And we've obviously got the Hobeck cat physically. She lives with us, Aki the cat.
And Cat Tutu.
And we have another cat now called Tinkerbell. Cats are everywhere. And in crime fiction, are really the marrow of crime fiction.
They are, but we think there should be more marrow.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we have decided to, commissioned Toby, and he has been working very hard with our huge technical centre that we've invested in to create ChatGPT. And this is a new approach to AI, which will basically works on a number of levels. But its number one aspect is that it involves more cat psychology and philosophy and thinking in the way that we create. And that means that we get a manuscript from one of our authors.
Say the next Lynn LaVersha.
The next
example.
Lynn LaVersha. Now, Lynn's books are brilliant, and one of the standout characters is Derek the dog.
Ah, key word there, dog.
And we ran it through ChatGPT, and Derek was replaced by
Delilah.
Delilah the cat.
The tabby cat.
Yes. And
sorry, Derek.
And yeah, it just had to be done. And as a consequence, when we ran this past our advanced reader group, the appreciation index that we got back was 20% higher.
We couldn't ignore that. We just couldn't.
And so we will be retrospectively replacing any dogs in Hobeck literature with cats using ChatGPT. And in future, we will also be including, one of our authors, Brian Price, is particularly keen to drop in the odd Easter egg as, little bits of hidden thing for aficionados to pick out from his works. And indeed, that will still be the case.
Mm.
But in future, ChatGPT will lace in things that will appeal to cat lovers and cats themselves.
If you're a fan of Brian Price's Fatal Trade and Fatal Hate, you will soon start seeing feline Easter eggs.
Yeah. It will extend to the way that we structure our novels in the future. Cats look at the world in a different way to we humans and indeed dogs or whatever.
You can't get murdered once in our books.
No.
Because you have 9 lives now.
Exactly. So ChatGPT is going to revolutionise the structure of what we do, the way that we think about it, the way that our audience will interact with it. And we know that, judging by the reaction we're already getting from the reworked material that we've got, we're getting such a positive reaction because, 90% of our readers are avowed cat lovers. And I think that affinity with cats comes through in the way that they interact with the work that we publish.
Absolutely. And we can't ignore the market.
We can't. And so I think it gives us a critical creative advantage over any other publisher out there.
No, I don't know anyone else who's doing this. So.
No, indeed. Now, the other thing that we're going to do is, we can't ignore the fact that we work in audio, my narration, that we will in future be creating audiobooks from our works that we have for a feline audience. And so ChatGPT can translate human words into cat speech and language for cats to appreciate.
That is very exciting.
It is. And, we are at the moment cloning Aki's voice because it's particularly powerful. And I mean, if a cat was to be the Brian Blessed of cats, it is Aki.
She is, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, she can't walk into a room without sort of bellowing that she's there. Whereas Tinkerbell really has a voice which is more suited to the softer, cozy crime books, I think.
Yeah,
and to some extent, I mean,
definitely.
She would be brilliant for, feline romances.
Oh, totally.
Tomcat meets, Princess Cat and, Streetwise Alley Cat.
There's a misunderstanding, there's a bit of jeopardy, and then you get together at the end.
So, the opportunities of ChatGPT are huge and endless, and, the question is, where can we take it?
Dragon's Den.
Probably. I look forward to, you know, standing in
front of... Shame it's not Cat's Den.
I think that Peter Jones will understand what we're, where we're coming from. I think Tuukka Suderman, it's probably
Stephen
a stretch for
Stephen Bartlett's going to go nuts for this.
Yeah, he is. He is. Yeah. This is the future. This is the future. And, you know, it's been a journey for us because, you know, I was without question, a Luddite when it came to AI.
He was.
But this is different. This is something that is going to change the world in a very positive way. This is not putting humans out of work. This is
giving
putting
cats
to work. Mm. And that's a good thing, surely.
It is a good thing, and we feel great for being pioneers in this.
Yeah, and you know, I want to give credit to Toby for the amount of work that he's put in. Indeed, all the support that we've had from the Hobeck community for this innovation. And so, as I say, April 1st, 2024, publishing will never be the same, and nor indeed will this podcast, as we celebrate Cat GPT. And on that bombshell, we ought to mention we've got a book out.
Last week we did,
yes. We did, yeah, there.
So that was launch. Never Forgive You by Hilly Barmby, which has had some great reviews so far.
Yeah, absolutely. And shortly before that, of course, we had The Thief of Joy from Stacey Murray. And we've got another, you know, we've got more books coming out now. It's April. Yeah. We can look forward to.
We've got Edge of the Land by Malcolm Holland-Drake, which is the third in the Merseyside crime series.
Very excited about that one.
We're relaunching Her Deadly Friend by Rachel Sargent with a new cover. So. Mm-hmm. That's in April as well. So we've got two in April.
Yeah, it's really,
we have a third. But it's on the last day of April. The Midnight Man by Julie Anderson.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, which is getting
great.
Sorry,
Julie.
There's a big article in the Crime Writers Association Red Herrings magazine that Julie's written about getting the historical facts right about 1946 and Clapham, where she has, you know, lives. And it's the first part of the Clapham trilogy.
And Julie's coming on the podcast in a couple of weeks too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look. What a day. It feels very special to have announced ChatGPT and broken cover after so many months of research and hard work.
Yeah, I know. We've been so busy. So apologies if we've been a bit off radar for a little bit.
But... Yeah, but you can now see why. It's you don't like the phrase, but I'm going to say game changing.
Yes, groundbreaking, cement breaking.
Blue sky thinking at its best. And with that, for myself, Adrian Hobart.
And myself, Rebecca Collins.
Thank you for joining us. Don't forget to check out the website www.hobeck.net for details of our authors, our books, our audiobooks, and everything else that we're up to. And, of course, the excitement that is being generated by ChatGPT. But from ourselves, we wish you a wonderful and
creative
week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.